exclusively on Paramount Plus. Get ready.
Vamanos!
To explore like never before.
Swiper knows. Swiping!
Oh, man!
Swing into action.
We need your help.
Woohoo!
Yay!
With a girl who put adventure on the map.
I don't think I can do it, Dora.
I'll protect you, Boots. Together, we got this.
Todos juntos!
Dora, the brand new series. Stream with your family now, exclusively on Paramount Plus.
From the world of Sonic the Hedgehog, a new hero arrives.
I am
ready. Is there anyone stronger?
No.
Tougher?
No.
Funnier?
I do not make jokes. I make warriors.
Knuckles, now streaming only on Paramount Plus.
Yes!
You know, I was doing, hey, Gary, I'm ready. I'm ready. And I did the whole script. Doing that. And Steve actually said to me, because if I had any guts at all, I would push for you to be the voice of SpongeBob. Because it's just wrong. It just would, it doesn't really
fit.
It
is wrong.
Yeah.
It is wrong.
But he goes, but no, he goes, but it's Plankton. It's Plankton.
Welcome to SpongeBob Binge Pants,
Nickelodeon's official podcast about all things SpongeBob.
I'm Hector Navarro.
And I'm Frankie Grande.
And we're back with another amazing interview. On today's episode, we're talking to...
Oh my goodness.
The one and only voice of Plankton, but also Larry the Lobster, Rube Goldfish, my leg, Fred.
Oh my god, my leg favorite guy.
So many amazing characters on SpongeBob SquarePants and all of the shows in the SpongeBob world. Plus, he is a writer, storyboard artist, director, has been working on the SpongeBob show since the very beginning. Mr. Lawrence is our guest today.
Oh my goodness, I'm so excited to talk to him. Mr. Lawrence, let's go.
The first question we've got is about your name, Mr. Lawrence. I think it's not a common thing in the world of cartoons to have a very kind of a formal credit. I feel like people think of the world of cartoons as being a little informal. So did Mr. Lawrence come from? Is there a story behind that?
Yeah, there's several, because I don't usually tell the same one twice. So
okay, thank you.
It's good.
Like Mark Twain, I got a new frog story for everything. It basically started as I wanted to do a comic strip, and so I wanted to have a cool signature, you know, and to draw. This is like in college. I love Dr. Seuss, so I thought, well, I'm not a doctor, but I am a mister, so let me try that. And it looked fun. It looked like it was funny. And then over the years, I would sign stuff that, and people would, you know, joke about it. Because I've been doing it since I was, I've been writing Mr. Lawrence since I've been, you know, 18, 19 or something. So it was kind of just a running joke, you know, and people would meet me and go, you're not Mr. Lawrence. You know, you're wearing a hoodie. So I was like, okay, well, it looked funny, and I just kept using it. And then officially with credits on shows, at a certain point, I decided to use it, you know, sort of full time. And it's still kind of a joke, because I don't feel like I'm grown up all the way. So Mr. always sounds true. It's silly.
Then you're in the right spot, because Hector and I talk about this all the time, that like we have not hit our adult phase of our life, even though we have been technically considered adults for
you're supposed
decades.
To. Yeah.
Decades.
They sent me brochures and it said, this is what you're supposed to do, but I've never followed it.
I mean, I don't know if you know anything about Hector and I, but we are massive, massive fans of SpongeBob.
I did know that,
Okay. Well, also, like, I am a massive fan of yours, because you do voice one of the most iconic characters, the character that everyone loves to... I think everyone actually just loves to love Plankton, to be honest.
At this point. They used to love to hate him. Now they just love him. Yeah,
he's just so great. And we're here with you, so I'm just so... I was going to ask you to prove it to our listeners, you just did.
Peekaboo, I see you. All right.
Oh my God.
Next question.
Next question. Well, anyway, you do multiple things. You know, you're not just a voice, you're a writer, and you've directed for this IP and for others. How would you describe your sense of comedy?
You know, it's always from influences, right? I mean, I grew up in a family that really cared about comedy. I was lucky. I got to see my grandfather's comedy, my father's comedy, and then I had my own comedy growing up. So it was sort of a history lesson in comedy all through my childhood because it was just always there. And so I kind of, it's kind of inevitable that I was going to do something that had to do with that because I was kind of got, unlike my family who just liked watching it, I got obsessed with it. Where I watched it over and over. You're watching this again? You know, it was like the kind of thing where you're always just obsessing on things. And that led to the cartoons I could always draw. So the cartooning thing led to animation and just being marveled by that. Just couldn't believe how amazing animation is. And then comedy. So it kept on going back and forth. And then, you know, I discovered Bugs Bunny and Tex Avery and Tom and Jerry and all those, the old theatrical shorts, and started to kind of put together some kind of a, whatever's your quivers in the, you know, whatever it's called. I'm not sure what I'm getting at here, but,
a palette.
That's the word. That's it. That's exactly it. I'm supposed to know these things, but, the palette is so many different things that it enabled me to want to get into comedy through also stuff that I was watching at that time as a kid as well. So it was always wanting to be a performer as well through all this comedy I was watching. So for a while I couldn't really decide what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to draw, which I could kind of do pretty well as a kid and develop that, or act. And so I just decided to not throw anything out and just keep developing all of it if I could. Yeah. So I've been lucky enough to be paid for those things, which is not a simple thing to get to for that to happen all by itself. So, you know, it's
oh my God, no, that's so exciting,
which is always okay, good. At least I can do that. I can do something that I've been sort of developing anyway. I'd probably be doing it, you know, if I wasn't doing it for a living, I'd still be on stage somewhere doing something.
Yeah. Are you saying that if you had been less successful in your voiceover career, that you would have fallen back and like, well, I'm a writer. Well, I'm going to do stand up. Well, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to keep doing this and this and this. That's great. And I feel like you would have you're so talented that you would have always been doing all of them all at once.
Yeah, at home. Yeah, in other places. Yeah. I'd be still doing it. But to be able to be, to catch on to something. I mean, like I said, our show, we just didn't think it was going to be on past a few seasons, you know, maybe two, maybe three, and then all of a sudden it was on, it won't go away. So we've always been, you know, amazed by that as the years roll by.
Wow. Yeah. What were the influences? Were they like, for me, it was like, I watched Nick at Night and it was like, I Love Lucy. And it was like Dick Van Dyke and like Mel Brooks. Like, what about, what was it for you that, what were those early?
Yeah, you nailed that with me. Mel Brooks was huge influence on me. And Monty Python also was, Monty Python's probably the reason that whatever the kind of thing I do connected to all these things and trying to be surreal most of the time. I like doing visual humor. And if you can get good dialogue mixed with the visual humor together, if you can really make a nice cocktail of that, it works. You know, it's so much fun to basically be in a lab making up jokes, you know, and figuring out, ooh, a pinch of this, and it's really funny. Not too much, you know, like that sort of stuff you go through when you're writing and building this stuff. And then getting a chance to actually write it and or draw it and then be able to go in a booth and then perform it. And then you change stuff when you're in the booth because you're feeling different about it when you're saying it, you know, and then, so you just keep hammering on it, you know, forever kind of, you just, you know, that's the, if you're in a good spot and you set it up right, you can make a conveyor belt for a show where you can really keep making it better as it goes down the conveyor belt. As it goes before it gets finished.
I Love Lucy reference.
Yeah, no, like a conveyor belt. That's Lucy right.
I love that's funny. It.
What I love about studying animation and being such a fan of animation is like Frank and I grew up when we were young watching Nickelodeon and watching cartoons, and we might not have been aware of your guys' influences.
Right.
And yet, the people that we've talked to so far, Frankie and I, there's been a lot of reference to Chuck Jones, Tex Avery, these kinds of great cartoon influences.
Yeah.
And we can get later into how that has absolutely found its way into SpongeBob, but I want to go back even further for a moment. I want to go back even further to the late 80s, early 1990s.
Okay, if you have to.
And I would love to ask about, I have to. Terrible time.
If you have to.
I do. Ren and Stimpy.
Yes.
You worked on Ren and Stimpy. How did you get that job, and what was it like working on that show at that time?
That's kind of the start of everything. I mean, that's what got me realizing I should come out to California, was seeing John Kay's, Christopher Lucy's, he did a video for the Rolling Stones called mm-hmm. Harlem Shuffle, I believe. And that had some really wild animation that he had was able to stick in there, and that popped up, and I tried to figure out who he was. And then a couple of years went by, I'm trying to, what happened to that guy, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, an animation magazine, it said that that John Kay had a new company called Spumco, and they were making this thing called Ren and Stimpy. So then I went nuts, because it was like right when I was out of school and looking for, you know, sending out my resume. And so I sent one to him, and he said, you know, we're not looking for anybody right now, but keep us posted, you know, we like your stuff, we'll talk whenever. So right after that, I sent out a lot of stuff, and I got a job at Film Roman, and I worked on the Tom and Jerry the movie.
Oh, I remember
from
that.
Then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do
you talk?
Too.
I didn't know you could talk. You could talk this whole time? Yeah, yeah,
it's,
that film.
That's
yep,
it.
I remember.
That's the one. Yeah. So that was my first official gig. And then all I did once I got here was pursue Spumco and try to get in there. So it took me about a year, under a year. And Vincent Waller and Richard Purcell, two of my old buddies now, then saw my resume, showed it to John, and I got asked to come in and interview with them. And
had the show even come out yet at this point, or were you still pursuing it and it still hadn't even premiered, Ren and Stimpy? Like, did you
no.
the show already come out?
No, what happened was is that in between going, I'm going to Hollywood, and me getting the job at Film Roman, Ren and Stimpy had started that September. I came out like in July, and then that September Ren and Stimpy premiered, right? So I spent another 6 months while they were still working on season one, trying to get in there. Finally got in there. Opening day, I go in there and they're screening Stimpy's Invention, which had just finished. So, and we were just dying. Our heads are falling off. It was so, so funny.
And so were theirs. Everyone's heads were falling off.
I thought, well, maybe I need to keep pursuing this if I was able to get here. I was kind of an assistant layout guy for a while, and then I moved, and character layout. And then I moved pretty quick into just full on, you know, doing my own layouts from the storyboards, which were awesome. It was a weird, you know, we were in the basement of this building on Melrose, and all these weird catacombs in the place, you know, that we found out were like, it was like a speakeasy from the 20s or something like that. So all these catacombs of people going in there to do God knows what, you know. So you're going through and seeing that, and right next door to us is a dentist. A child dentist is next door. So all morning, you're hearing screaming kids. You're hearing kids screaming. You're hearing kids screaming who are getting the drill, and kids in the waiting room screaming because they're hearing the kid getting the drill. So it just sounded like, you know, they were torching, you know, a daycare. It was everyone's just afraid, you know, scared. It was horrible. But yeah, that was... That was one of the things we made fun of it. Of course, it was funny, but
of course, use it for inspiration. Put a microphone
absolutely.
In there, put it in the show. You know,
we're all feeling the pain.
Little Shop of Horrors right next door.
Yeah, it's good to feel. It's always good to feel a little pain before you start doing comedy.
We go from Ren and Stimpy, and then you are working as a storyboard artist on Rocco's Modern Life.
Yeah.
Rocco's Modern Life.
Amazing.
And then in there.
Yes, I was.
There it is.
Hello? Is somebody there?
Sorry.
Hello?
I got stuck.
Wait, how are you?
I get stuck doing it.
Sorry. I wish we did more of those because I love doing that character.
Oh my God. I loved Rocco's Modern Life so much.
Thank you. That was my real comedy college. Cause I was an artist on Ren and Stimpy, but on Rocco, I was a director and I did the storyboards and I did voices and got to direct voices sometimes too, which was nice.
Wow. How did the transition into also doing voices happen? Was it just an organic thing? Like, hey, I'll do it.
Yeah, well, I had been doing, like I said, when I got into comedy, I actually got into comedy. I was doing stand-up for about 3 years before, like in the college years. And so before I came out to California, that's sort of what I was doing, is trying to establish myself as a comic. And I had a drawing bit. You know, I used to draw, do caricatures of people and stuff like that. Yeah,
great.
Said it was fun, brilliant. A lot of fun. But this took over. The boom happened in animation just as the boom was going down in stand-up comedy. And so it was harder to get stage time, but there was jobs open for artists and, you know, people like that. But the voiceover thing happened because I had already had a background in it, I'm assuming. But what it really was they couldn't find a voice for Filbert. And it really went on past the point where I shouldn't have gotten that voice. They just were, you know, they just were being neglectful. And they weren't paying attention. And finally got down to, oh my God, we got to get this together. You know, we're going to be airing soon. It's coming up. So we got to get, you know, we got to figure out who's playing what in all these parts. And so I put a tape in, because I kept doing a voice for Filbert in the pitches that was making the guys laugh. So I said, well, I'll throw this in and see what happens. So I did a whole thing. I read one of my scripts, you know, one of my storyboards out with the character, put in the thing. I didn't put my name on it. The only people who knew were the PAs who were doing the casting stuff.
Oh my God.
So Joe Murray got to hear it without knowing it was me.
Whoa.
Even though I was there already, you know, doing that. And so apparently I was not in the room. He stood up and went, "That's it. Who is he? That's the guy." and they went like this. They all put their heads down. They went, "Oh, of course." And they said, "What?" He goes, "What? Who is it?" He goes, "It's Doug." So the implication was, you know, oh, we're gonna have to, you know, now he's already working here, how's this gonna work, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so they asked me, are you okay doing that? You're gonna have to, you know, one day a week, you're gonna have to go do voices, you're still gonna have to get your deadlines. I said, no, I'm everything, I want to do everything, you know, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Do it.
Wow.
We have been loving not only, you know, the classic SpongeBob here, but like everything in, you know, the new IP, the spinoff, like everything that is this in this world of SpongeBob, which has just gotten so massive and included the other shows, which you also work on and are also brilliant. We love Camp Coral. I am a massive fan of the Patrick Star Show.
Awesome.
Like, what insanity.
I know. We're very proud of that, that you just said that. We're very proud of that show being just plain nuts. That's what we want.
Plain nuts. And I
Monty Python. Back to Monty Python.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. Absurd. And that's also why I called that Mel Brooks earlier. It just feels like that just kind of humor. And I love it, obviously.
That's so great.
Have you consciously kind of sped up the pace of the show?
I think when you write this kind of thing, and then you're sort of tasked to come up with alternate versions of these things, you start figuring, well, I can't do the show. Patrick's show can't be SpongeBob. It can't be the same thing. If it was the same thing, it would get boring fast, because it would just be the same kind of storytelling and the same kind of, you know, narratives. So we, yeah, very conscious after Camp Coral, after we knew Camp Coral was going to pretty much be SpongeBob too. Mm-hmm. And that it was going to be in a new location and have that sort of, you know, part of the universe. Mm-hmm. Then we just sort of said, Patrick's show has to be different. It's got to stand out. It's got to feel like something else. So that was the whole point, was how do we do that? How do we make something work? So it took a while to figure out what the platform was going to be. You know what I mean? What the box was that we're keeping these characters in, what's the framing device, you know, for this show, what are we doing? And all the stuff we love, Monty Python and you know, old comedy, you know, old absurd, more absurdist comedy stuff that we love, was all coming to the surface. And we're like talking about all those things and watching those things and getting excited again, going, could we really do that? Could we really just cut to this and cut to that and have a time machine, and who cares where they go here to there? It's not, and it's not even a sense of, I just said, who cares? It's not really who cares. It's precision comedy. It's just, it's just done off narrative. It's done off, we're off the rails and we're in the dirt. We're in the primal, you know, all the primal urges of comedy that we had. It's The Patrick Show.
It's so great and it's so entertaining. And to me, I mean, whether or not it was intentional or not, like, I do feel like it is grasping younger audiences in a way which is absolutely necessary because mm-hmm. of the fact that they were so overstimulated as, like, little kids now. Like, I watch little kids, like, staring at their iPad, like, walking around, like, on a playground. And I'm like, you're multitasking. Good for you.
I know. No, I don't know if we did that on purpose. I don't know if it was a conscious effort to make it faster. I think it's mm-hmm. a matter of, in some cases, it's like Python. We want to throw a lot at you. How many things can we throw at you per square inch? You know, like, as you're moving through this, how many jokes can we toss at one time? And so, because of that, I think it makes it, even if it's at times it'll make it seem faster, even if it isn't. But I think it is, there is a pace thing. And I have it in my own work when I make my own short films. I like to keep things fast. And
mm-hmm. It's great. Pace.
Tex Avery, you know, it's mostly yep. Tex. It's Tex's influence. His speed in animation was, and everybody else did it too, but he's the guy who did it. You know, he nailed it, man. That's the best stuff. That still astounds me when I watch it today. I'll watch stuff we do and I'll go, we got so close to something that I, you know, is my favorite thing or my favorite cartoon. We're almost there with the animation and everything. It's just hard to beat 1940s animation, man. That stuff is just like so amazingly
hot. But you're doing it for the next generation
hot.
Of people. Yeah. The next generation of people will be like, oh my God, if we could only do what that Patrick Star episode did. Yep. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
Until they watch the old Tex Avery cartoons. I'm like, oh, this guy.
And they were like, never mind.
Never mind.
That's what I like.
That's what I love. It's great.
I am so excited now. I get to ask about Plankton, one of my favorite characters in cartoon history, Doug. One of the best.
Yes.
I'm wearing my Plankton green shirt today.
Of course.
In honor of in honor of Sheldon. But here's the thing I did not know. I just learned this, Mr. Lawrence. You initially auditioned for SpongeBob, the character.
Oh, yeah.
With the Plankton voice.
Oh, yes, I did.
Dude, we got to hear that. Give us a little bit of what SpongeBob says in the Plankton voice, because that audition, it seems insane to me, like it would never work because I'm so used to you doing Plankton. But what was that audition like?
That came from when the pilot was being made, when Steve Hillenburg was working on the pilot. Mm-hmm. And we had been both at Rocco together. And we were close on that and very blown away by each other's work and influenced by each other's work. And so when we were both trying to sell shows, we both said to each other, if I get a show, you're coming with me, right? And and if I get my show, you're coming with me, right? So, so it was one of those sort of situations. And then, SpongeBob, they were making the pilot. And so everybody was auditioning and I had to give a tape in, to audition for all the characters. And then at the end, I did the Plankton voice and I was just went off the dialogue that was there and for the character. Plankton was not in the pilot and was not part of the presentation or anything. Mm-hmm. So I knew he was part of the Bible because Steve had told me and I'd seen the Bible already. So this was all about just me doing a funny voice on audition tape that I know Steve's going to listen to with Derek Dryman and Eric Weiss in the room and they're going to laugh. So I made them laugh. So it turns out later I found out not only did they play it in the room many times for each other to laugh when they'd get like depressed or the deadlines were looming, they'd play this tape of me and I was walking around my kitchen just stomping pots and pans and throwing stuff in this whole thing. So eventually that ended up getting, this is a funny little stupid thing too, is eventually they played it for Tom Kenny, who had come to visit while he was auditioning. And when we finally did the pilot, you know there's that one scene where you might remember, there's a scene where for a second when SpongeBob first comes to the Krusty Krab, he talks sort of like a superhero.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
He says, I've been waiting for a long time for this. That's Tom doing me. That's Tom making a joke as a joke and started doing me in the record and they left it in.
Wow.
And
so you are in the pilot. You are in the pilot.
So I always say in a very small way, I made it to the pilot anyway.
Wow.
And so that became the thing. And of course, Steve goes, It's great, though. I love that voice. It can't be, you know, because I was doing, you know, I was doing, hey, Gary, I'm ready. And I did the whole script doing that. And Steve actually said to me, because if I had any guts at all, I would push for you to be the voice of SpongeBob. Because it's just wrong. It just wouldn't, it doesn't really fit.
It is wrong.
Yeah.
It is wrong.
But he goes, but it's Plankton. It's Plankton, you know. And the other reason that Tom made fun of me in the record and was doing my voice or imitating what became the Plankton voice was because in Rocco Records, I would often do that Plankton voice to make Tom laugh. Mm-hmm. We would all do stuff and I would have like a citizen number four, you know, some side character, and I'd be waiting knowing I'm going to talk to Tom in a second, and I would just have that voice loaded and he wouldn't know I'm going to do it, and I'd say, "How you doing, friend?" And he would just you know, laughing his head off, and so he remembered it from that. So it's been this weird thing. Wow. With that voice and Tom and our connection.
And so and Steven Hillenburg, Steven told you, you'll just play Plankton when the show gets picked up. And you were like, that's not gonna happen.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, great. No paycheck there. Yeah, I was like, that's not gonna work. So, and I didn't know. We all were hoping for each other when we do these things, but you're always skeptical, especially when I was hoping I was going to be Squidward at one point. I was like, oh, maybe I'll get to be Squidward then, you know, instead. Ah, and I can't be in the pilot. Oh. So I ended up just holding it. And then, you know, whatever it was, like 2 years later, year and a half later or something, we started the show. And Steve's like, so you're Plankton, right? I said, yeah, I guess so. And then, of course, they wanted the stunt cast because it was a character that's going to show up every once in a while. So they put me through the ringer, you know, to audition for it. I auditioned for it like maybe six times, something like that. Just kept, where I'd write copy for myself, type it up, go downstairs, you know, to the record and record it and then send it to them. And they kept going on and on. And then they said, they don't know. They prefer if you did stunt casting, you know, really. And then we decided that Brass was coming in from New York. I think that's what was happening. And we decided to pitch them the Plankton storyboard live. So the guys who drew the storyboards, you know, pointed to all the stuff and said the story. And I stood a few, you know, like over here going, you know, like this on the corner going, it's my birthday, you know, like thinking. So every line got a laugh in the room.
Oh my God.
And got a big applause at the end that this is this new character we're presenting with this little guy with this big crazy voice. And they said, they all turned, and the president at the time of Nickelodeon goes, I guess you're Plankton, you know, and then they just walked out of the room. So I didn't realize how it was really hanging specifically on this performance, but I was ready. So
that's amazing. Just very Singing in the Rain. Just the you're behind the curtain, you're doing the thing, and they just pull the curtain open and you're like, you're the guy.
That's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I love that you got this massive entrance. You're the Christina Aguilera in Moulin Rouge. You're the one that everyone is waiting for when that bridge is ramping up. Like, everyone's been introduced already. We know about Maya and Little Kim. They've all done their thing. And now comes Christina Aguilera. Mm-hmm. Here you are. Plankton.
Wow,
exclamation point.
Right.
Is the name of the episode.
Right. We tried. And it was actually called Deep Cover. That was my original title. But it was, we talked about it, and it was decided that we needed to introduce this guy,
Plankton,
you know, because we're doing a whole episode about him, and he's going to be making a comeback later because of the Chum Bucket, so we figured we should, you know, make it just Plankton. We laughed. I was like going, who cares?
I love it.
Like, why was it called Plankton with an exclamation point? Wow, aren't you special?
Yeah. Frankie, also, now I want like a Plankton cover of Christina Aguilera's bit in Lady Marmalade. Now I want that.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Yeah,
I'll do it.
Yeah, oh, please do it.
Sure.
Please do it.
Somebody send him the lyrics now, quick.
So not only are you Plankton, the most iconic in the world, and you're also Larry the Lobster, who we have talked about on our show. how much we love Larry.
Hey!
Hey, how you doing? You want to go lift some weights, Larry?
I want to lift some... Yeah, that's all I say. That's my... Yeah. That's my, you know, ramp up words, because that's the first thing I ever said with that character. And that's what always ends up happening. Yeah. Hey, SpongeBob! Want to lift some weights? And that was the... So I just keep saying that over and over, and it always makes... That makes Tom laugh, too, and the others, because it's... They know... They know why I'm doing it. It's because I'm trying to remember what that character sounds like. It's getting easier because I do a lot more Larry now than I used to, because he's on Camp Coral. He's on all the shows, and then particularly on Camp Coral a lot more. And so I get to do more with him.
Well, hang on a second. Hang on a second. Mr. Lawrence, you should know that Frankie's maybe favorite character in SpongeBob, but absolutely favorite background character is the Fred My Leg guy.
Oh my God.
And
yeah,
Carolyn told us the story about how you did that when you guys were doing Crowdwalla.
Yeah, and it just sounded funny. Yeah, it was one of those ones that we do. Everybody's screaming things for a walla, and then all of a sudden, everyone's trying to say the last thing before the walla stops. And so that's like a joke. It's called a Danny Man. I don't know why, but he's a voiceover actor who apparently always had to get the last word in. So we joke. Always doing that, and for some reason I was able to time it well a few times where everyone had stopped, and then I yelled, you know, my leg, and so it was able to and make everyone laugh because they weren't expecting there to be one more. So it was sort of like, so somehow, because everyone laughed in the room, whether that means it was really funny or not, not just a surprise, it got into those. It started getting into shows. The sound guys would use it specifically,
it's a cult following, right?
Like, it became a thing. Yeah.
Yes, the My Leg line has become an absolute cult following. It was like, so my sister would just run around the house screaming it like our whole life, like back and forth to us and to her friends. Like it was just like My Leg and different one, My Leg, like just different versions of the My Leg. There's YouTube videos that are like 7 minutes long of you just saying My Leg. The compilations,
I know, they're so funny. Yeah, and I wrote a show in season 11 or 12 called My Leg, which was about Fred, because we just figured we got to service this growing audience. So we wanted to make something else for him. And we do more with him here and there, but that was that's maybe my favorite thing I ever wrote was that episode.
Really?
Oh my God. I really thought that was just to take something that was a throwaway line and it turns into this, you know, episode with a music, you know, with a song at the end, and just making that stupid idea into something bigger was always, it's fascinating to when it works.
And it's a dream, and you're listening to the audience too. Like it's it's so exciting.
We're like, hey, they like it, so I'll do more of that. Sure.
Exactly. Like, all right, I guess that's the best thing ever.
Yeah, and like Rube. I mean, he's another one. He's He's my favorite new character. Oh my goodness.
He's amazing.
And he's Huell Hauser, so he's one of my favorite, if you guys remember Huell Hauser from years back.
I discovered Huell Hauser. I'm a born and raised Californian, but I did not know about Huell Hauser until a friend of mine showed me this. So could you explain who Huell Hauser is in case our listeners don't know who this man is?
Yeah, Huell was a guy who went around mostly PBS kind of stations, and he had a traveling show. He'd go around and just stop at places of interest in California. California's gold. And it was his show, and he had several shows over the years, but that was his job. He was able to carve out this job, and he was just such an affable, nice guy who had this kind of a voice, and everything was amazing. He couldn't believe anything, and any time, and we just always would sit and laugh because we knew he was sincere. I think that's why he's so funny, because you know he means it. And it was just so, you know, we'd just sit and laugh.
He'd be looking at mountains and he's just like, wow, look at that. Like, it's just the most amazing, sincere thing. Yeah, it's so great.
Well, what's great is when he's going over food. He's like, look at this. Wow, look at that tomato. Oh, my goodness. Is this a normal size for a tomato? Because that's huge.
And speaking of having these positive characters and these characters that live in like kind of like this cynicism world, you get to like do both, which is that super fun, and also you get to write for both. So like How does that duality play out in your mind? Do you have to like put on a switch and be like, I'm the peppy optimistic one right now?
Yeah, no, it's kind of a, they're really kind of separate items. You really do, for me, you step out of a car and then you step into a train, you know, it's like, it's sort of like two separate things, because I really, when I'm at doing voices, I don't necessarily, I'm certainly not married to anything I write when I'm in the booth. I'm really married wow. to it before we get to the booth.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and don't you touch, you know, my stuff. But after that, there's the process moves, and I got used to it over the years of throwing out things that I thought were the funniest thing I ever wrote, you know, or the, you know, this has to be in there. It's like, no, it doesn't. What has to be in there is what ends up being in there. So you kind of, it's a stew and you have to put the right ingredients in it. If there's too much, you know, paprika, then you know, less paprika.
It really is joke formulas with you. It really, you really are putting a dash of this, a pinch of this.
It always feels like it. It feels like a Dr. Frankenstein sort of a laboratory thing, you're trying to come up with stuff. Because we do a lot, you know, we make up a lot of stuff that we can't say, that we would love to say.
I think it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Oh, yes? That's right. Yeah. That's right. I'm sorry.
But
I'm sorry.
One of the things that Frankie and I keep bringing up is this amazement that, like, we're going back and we're re-watching the first batch of episodes. We're rewatching this first season of SpongeBob while also, you know, being aware of what you guys are doing now. And so many of you creative, brilliant geniuses have really been there since the beginning, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, you have a really unique perspective too, because not only are you in the writer's room, you're the story editor, but you're also in the voiceover booth and you're this great connective thread and you've been there since the beginning. Do you feel like you sometimes have a responsibility to, when you think about what SpongeBob was in the beginning and what it is now, and to kind of keep that going? I know that I've heard that writers have come up to you and they're like, well, I'm referring to this thing that happened in season one. And you're like, oh, I pitched that. That's my idea.
Right. Wow. Right.
So that you're still sort of overseeing that world a little bit. Do you feel that responsibility?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Especially with Steve gone, it's been more of a, if we're going to keep doing this, if we're going to keep up with this, it's got to be of the quality that, of the bar that was already set. You know what I mean? Right. The bar was already set at a high place. And so the only place for us to go is higher, not lower. So we go out of our way to try to put more animation in over the last 5-6 years. More attention to detail, working with newer other artists, bringing in guest artists to work with here and there. You know, I mean, we're lucky we got some of the best people in the world, you know, drawing the show. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that that people are still on board with the other things, the other versions of the show, and still be okay is wanting to see the original. And you know, so it's which is amazing to us at all. It shows you how much people love these characters already. But for us, there was something to it where we said, well, it can't just be about that, though. It's got to be about, the shows are too good, you can't turn them off. They have to be so funny that you go, I got to watch another one of these. So we try to make each one, you know, a nice little, you know, bonbon each time. You know, we try to make it like a real... each one is a classic. That's what I used to joke. I said, everyone's got to be a classic. You know,
we've said that so many times in the show already.
It's because it's enthusiasm too. We want it. We want to do this. Yes. You know, we love writing these things and we love these characters. These guys are all part of us now. Plankton's definitely second nature. You know, if I get hit in the head really hard at some point, I'm probably going to be babbling and just doing Plankton's voice, you know, down by the railroad tracks, but there's, you know, a lot of...
I would love if you got into a fight with someone as Plankton and they just didn't know. Like, all of a sudden, you're in there, like,
someone is? Yeah. A piece of me?
I just throw it at them. Yeah. I've been able to throw every so often when we're down in the parking decks, when we'd be going to our cars, they'd say, hey, Doug, do it. And I would... scream, and I would just give a scream that would reverberate, you know, through the rafters of the place as loud as I could.
So some of the new stuff in Camp Coral are the characters Narlene and Nobby, who you also helped create. Tell us a little bit about those characters and what your thinking was when you guys were developing those.
Yeah, well, we knew we needed... The studio actually said we needed some new characters. If we're going to have the new series, you got to at least throw in one or two new guys. So we... That was a real thing of trying to figure out for a couple of weeks or something, who's going to be these new characters? Because you can't just go, oh, it's this, and you throw it in there. You know, it was definitely something we had to figure out. And because they are out in the camp and in the woods, it suggested that she, whoever it is, would live out in the woods. So we had a lot of really
great,
creepy characters at first before we got to Narlene and Nobby. You know, old men who live in the woods by themselves, that kind of stuff.
Hey, kids.
Yeah, exactly. And we said, well, that's good for a gag, but not for a recurring character, you know. So we got it down to having a brother and a sister. So there was a few iconic things from our childhood that we remembered for her, and one of them was Pippi Longstocking, if you remember those old movies that were old when I saw them. You know, just about a very, very almost Bugs Bunny kind of trickster female character. And we really liked the idea of that she'd always be, you know, tricking them, not where she's hurting anybody, but where she's having fun, you know, and Nobby's having fun too. And he loves, they just like conning people.
And so we have the Patrick Show, and we have Camp Coral, and we have SpongeBob, and we have movies. Like, what is there in your mind a future of SpongeBob that you can see? Like, what does that mean for the world? Are we just going to live in SpongeBob land? Because I want to do that.
I assume you do. Great.
Yes.
Sign up. I'm sure there's a sign up for it somewhere. Yeah, you can probably. Yeah. There's probably a GoFundMe for it already. I don't know. It's hard to tell because certain characters, they go away, they come back. You know, maybe SpongeBob will go away for a while like Bugs Bunny did, and then he'll come back and everyone will know him again. We try to make the show, you know, not topical. We only do shell phones when we need it. You know, we kind of try to stay away from cell phones and those things just to sort of keep it a little more timeless, you know?
Yeah.
So we've always been conscious of that. But I think that's part of it, too, is just that you can relate to it in any time period. We're skeptical as to whether putting new shows with the same characters was a mistake. So we wanted to make quality shows and funny shows, and I think they are. So you don't have to like all of them or any of them. But I think the fact that it's still there now and we're still making these things at this point is a good sign for the future. I think it'll be around at least a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And maybe there's room for it in the future. I hope there's still slapstick humor in the future. I hope there's still room for, you know, my leg and junk like that.
So, we do too.
I don't know.
It's even funny when you say it quiet, Mr. Lawrence. It's
is it?
Funny.
That's,
like, it was
thank
funny
you.
When you. Yes, it was because I wasn't expecting it. You snuck what a my I leg snuck in there, and so I really appreciate that.
Heartfelt my leg.
Yeah,
that's right.
Heartfelt. Yeah, really sweet my and heartfelt. Leg. I don't know. Hope there's room for my leg. You know?
Yeah, I've done it. Oh, man. In that one episode, I did it so many different ways.
Yeah.
Definitely sweating after that one.
You had Tom as SpongeBob doing it. It's so fun. It's so great when everybody got in on it. It was so funny.
That was so funny. I so enjoyed
that. I think the future of SpongeBob, to go back to what we were talking about before, is that students of animation, people who are going back and studying animation and they're looking at cartoons from the 1940s, which cannot be beat, they're going to look at cartoons from the late 90s, early 2000s, 2010s, now into 20s, and they're going to go,
wow,
SpongeBob can stand shoulder to shoulder with those other shows.
Yeah.
That's
because
a nice
of
thought.
The love and care. It's not a thought. It's a reality. It is fact. It is a reality.
It really is.
It is a scientific fact.
Yeah, yeah. I like the thought of it a lot. It's hard for me to... It's hard for me to believe that all the way. I've seen fans over the years, and people tell me stories of, you know, things that they got through, you know, tragedies in their lives because of the show, and that's hard for me to fathom. All these things of the love that comes from people liking the show as much as they do is overwhelming. So it's hard for me to, and I often forget it. Until we go to a fan show, and then we're like, "Oh my god!"
You know? Yeah, exactly. And I mean, listen, you are on SpongeBob Binge Pants.
Yeah,
you're
I know,
a podcast dedicated to the genius of your show and to breaking it down for the thousands and thousands and millions of fans that are around the world that are just so in love with what you guys have created and will continue to be.
Thank you.
So I thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have me. Yeah. Anytime you want to talk about stuff, let me know.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Frankie, another amazing interview on the books. Mr. Lawrence, we thank him so much for spending his valuable time with us. He's such a busy guy, and that was a lovely, lovely, lovely interview with the busiest, busiest man. That was fantastic.
Thank you guys for listening to our amazing conversation. I look forward to the next one on SpongeBob Binge Pants, and we'll see you guys soon next week.
Bye.
Bye.